Good morning. Up right now on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville, it's the Mind and Heart Show. For the next hour, it's thoughts and feelings and the way they affect our lives and the world we live in. The phone number in the studio is 434-284-9470. Now here's your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier.
Good morning, Charlottesville, and welcome to the Mind and Heart Show. I am your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. We're going to go to the news, and then we'll be back with you in just a moment. Stay tuned. Good morning, Charlottesville, and welcome back to the Mind and Heart Show. I'm your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. We are here every Saturday morning from 9 until 10 a.m. My producer today is Morgan Geyer. Please join us by visiting our Facebook page, which is Mind and Heart Show. You can post a question there. You can send us a tweet at MindHeartWPVC. You can email us at MindHeartWPVC@gmail.com. You can also call us in the studio if you have a question today at 284-9470. On the Monday following our show, if you're unable to listen to our entire show today, you can stream the show at SevillePodcast.com. Just go to SevillePodcast.com. and put Mind and Heart in the search box, and it'll bring up all of our shows, including the one today. I'm joined in the studio by my guest this morning. I'm very pleased to welcome Chuck Collins, who is the recently retired human rights advocate at Western State Hospital, which is one of the large state-run hospitals for the mentally ill. And I want to welcome Chuck. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. And it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So, Chuck, tell us a little bit, share with us your background. I'm interested in our listeners knowing something about how you got into this line of work and what, where does your interest in human rights work, where did that originate?
Okay. Well, as you said, I just retired actually 1 year ago after 26 years as the regional advocate from the Office of Human Rights. The Office of Human Rights is part of the Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Services for the Commonwealth of Virginia. So I've been stationed at Western State Hospital, but actually I've served not only the patients at Western State Hospital, but also folks in the community. And so the department calls it Health Planning Region Number 1. So that's 7 community services boards, 125 licensed private organizations, as well as the 2 facilities operated by the department, Western State being one of them.
Okay. And just so our listeners know, community service boards, for those of you that don't know that term, are the outpatient mental health clinics that are primarily funded by the state with some help from the localities.
Exactly.
Is that correct, Chuck?
Okay. Yes.
Now, you are by training an attorney.
Yes.
So tell us about your educational background.
Well, graduated with my BA back in, well, I don't want to say that.
Okay. Probably a long more time recently ago. Than I did. But
after I graduated from college, I got my master's degree. I went to Catholic University in D.C. and got a master's degree in social work and thought that I was going to be a social worker. That's what I really wanted to do. And then practiced social work, first in the Army for 4 years when I was on active duty, and then for another 8 years at the University of Virginia at the Children's Rehabilitation Center, which is now recently thought of as Kluge Rehabilitation Center.
Right.
And then from there, because of some experiences that I had, I decided I wanted to expand my horizons and go to law school. So I did that. Plus, the GI Bill benefit was still available. So I went to law school. I went to Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington. And then came back to Charlottesville. By the way, I have to say this. The Children's Rehab Center was the best job that I ever had.
Golly.
I still have friends today who were my friends 30-some years ago at the Children's Rehab Center.
Which has recently been consolidated downtown in the Battle Building, I believe. They've moved all those children's programs into the battle building.
And they've lost something wonderful.
Yeah, that campus, I thought, was wonderful. Yeah.
And I have to say this. I met my wife at the CRC, and that's the best thing that ever happened to me. And I'm hoping that, even though she's not probably listening, I think my kids might be. So the best thing about me is my wife and my three kids, Chris, Gina, and Patrick.
That's great. Well, if she's not listening, we can get her the podcast on Monday. So
thanks.
you can get some brownie points.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. So how did this evolve into an interest in human rights with the mentally ill and with the developmentally delayed populations?
So the job that I had for 26 years was really a marriage between my social work and my legal training. It really encompassed both things. So when I graduated from law school in 1985, my wife and I and our son Chris came back to Charlottesville, and I needed a job. So the job that I got, and it was a wonderful job, was the executive director of the Arc of the Piedmont.
Okay, sure.
And I met many wonderful people there. In fact, that's like my alma mater. The Arc of the Piedmont is my alma mater, and it's what I'm doing now. I'm a consultant with the Arc now.
Okay, and tell us what the Arc of the Piedmont is for those of our listeners who don't know.
Originally, back in 85, the organization was called Charlottesville Albemarle Association for Retarded Citizens. Today, we call it Arc of the Piedmont. And the Arc of the Piedmont is led by John Santosky, who's doing an excellent job, and by Barbara Barrett, who's the president of the board of directors. And if I have a chance later on, I got to tell you about Barbara Barrett, because she wrote a wonderful book, and she should be a guest on your program and an upcoming session.
Great. We'll get in touch with her.
Good.
So how would you define human rights as it relates to these populations of the mentally ill or the developmentally delayed or developmentally handicapped?
Jeff, I could give you a history of the legislative background of human rights in Virginia if we had time. But the succinct version is this. There was a federal case in 1972. Think of it this way, human rights, conceptually. We had the civil rights movement. We had the women's movement. We had the disability movement. We had forays of individuals coming forward and asserting their rights in our society. So the year was 1972, and the case was Wyatt v. Stickney, and it was decided in Alabama, and institution that was cited was probably one of the worst offenders in terms of disrespecting the human rights of individuals. The institution was a hospital that engaged in warehousing, essentially, rather than active treatment, and was rife with abuses and basically a lack of appropriate treatment.
Mm-hmm.
It was the test case that was used in the federal government, I'm sorry, in the federal courts to decide the right to treatment.
Okay.
And other fundamental human rights. And from the decision in that case came what we have in Virginia today. So Wyatt v. Stickney was decided in 1972, and in 1975, the General Assembly adopted all of the recommendations from the Wyatt v. Stickney case and incorporated them in the statutes of Virginia.
Okay.
So we have human rights regulations beginning in 1975.
Okay. Can you give us just a snapshot, perhaps, of a case, it could be hypothetical, where someone in one of these institutions or being treated outpatient has been denied their rights? What would that look like?
Well, because of the structure that was imposed prior to 1975, we didn't have a human rights system in Virginia. But at that point in time, the statute was 37.1-84.1, retention of rights, it was called. And the statute laid down basic fundamental rights that all people who were in programs licensed, funded, or operated by the Department of, in those days, Mental Health, Mental Retardation, and Substance Abuse Services could enjoy. And that set down the blueprint for the human rights system. And it also promulgated regulations, human rights regulations, that were mandated upon all parties who were serving people in these categories: mental health, intellectual disabilities, and substance abuse services. If you want to be licensed by the state, you have to have strict conformity to the human rights regulations. So you asked me the question, what does a human rights complaint look like? Well, a human rights complaint is something that is an alleged violation of the rights that clients have. The most fundamental human right that any person has is the right to treatment with dignity. Treatment with dignity means the right to be safe. The right to be safe in your own environment, whether it's at Western State Hospital, whether it's at the clubhouse at Region 10, whether it's at a group home operated by Arc of the Piedmont. The first and foremost right somebody has is the right to be safe. And we say that in the way of, we call it the right to treatment with dignity, because under treatment with dignity is this fundamental, most important right, the right to be protected from harm, abuse, and exploitation.
Okay. You know, what comes to mind is sort of a really egregious example of this were for what went on for years in the so-called training schools with the involuntary sterilization.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, that right. That was happening in our adult lifetime. I'm not sure when it ended, but I'm thinking it's not been that long ago.
For people who want to get up to speed with that issue, a former professor at the University of Virginia and former director of the Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy, his name was Paul Lombardo, and I considered him to be one of my mentors.
I know of him, yes.
Because he was both a psychologist and an attorney.
Right.
And he wrote an excellent work on the Supreme Court decision of Buck v. Bell.
Yep.
And talked about the whole involuntary sterilization movement in Virginia and how that has been discredited, and under Governor Warner even reparations have been made or attempted.
Yeah, shameful chapter in our history. So do these issues of human rights, do they relate primarily to the administration of psychotropic or psychiatric drugs to these individuals? I know that's always kind of a hot topic, whether someone can refuse medication or, you know, are they being forced to take them?
Right. Medications for clients with mental illness, medications is one of the, if not the most primal issues to be considered. So here's how it plays out. If you look at conceptually the human rights regulations, and I'm going to be a little bit simplistic here, it basically boils down to three fundamental issues. Number one, clients retain all of their legal, civil, constitutional rights just as any other citizen would have in any situation. Second, everyone shall, and this is the inviolable right, be treated with dignity and respect at all times, to be safe and also to be treated with common courtesy and dignity at all times. That one cannot be abridged.
Okay.
And number three, everything that a provider does must be done within the concept of sound therapeutic practice. So those are the three basic tenets that are interwoven throughout the human rights regulations. With respect to the administration of psychotropic medications, a big issue. First of all, thank God for psychotropic medications. Yeah. Medications that have changed the course of persons' lives for the better.
Absolutely.
Ever since the early 90s when they first came on the scene. There was a standard of care that did not contain psychotropic medications prior to the advent of Clozaril and its derivative medications prior to the early 90s. Well, that was one standard of care, far lower than what it is today with Clozaril and its successive medications. So now we have these medications, and they're there to be offered to patients. But the fundamental right of a patient remains the whole concept of informed consent.
Right.
Do they have the right to refuse medications? And of course the answer is yes. They have the right to refuse. You have the right to refuse medications offered to you by your treating physician, don't
Absolutely,
you?
Absolutely, yes.
All right. Same thing applies to our clients with mental illness, even our clients in the hospital.
Right.
Okay. So can they in every situation refuse medications? No. There are times when medications can be imposed upon an individual. On 5 East at the University of Virginia.
Spent many hours there.
The inpatient psychiatric unit at UVA, an excellent program, by the way. I've been very familiar with that through my whole career.
Right.
There are times when a person's right to refuse is not granted, and that is when it is an emergency.
Right.
If a person is facing an emergency, that means they are engaging in behavior which there is an imminent risk of harm to themselves or others, then basically their right to refuse has been surrendered.
Yeah. Right. Let's take a short break. We're here this morning with Chuck Collins, an attorney and who specializes in human rights, particularly with regard to the mentally ill and the developmentally delayed. So we'll be right back. And we are back. This is your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. You're listening to the Mind and Heart Show on WPVC 97.4 FM. We are the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Quick check of the weather before we get back to our guest this morning. It's currently 32 degrees in Charlottesville, a bit nippy out there this morning. Sunny, no clouds to speak of, so we're going to get a high of about 50 today. Looks like zero chance of precipitation and fairly low winds, so should be a nice day. Tomorrow looks about the same, maybe a little higher actually tomorrow, about 66 and sunny. So maybe spring is trying to finally assert itself. So we're back with our guest, Chuck Collins, an attorney and a specialist in human rights, particularly with regards to the person suffering from mental illness or developmental delays or disabilities. And Chuck, we were talking about medication, and I wanted to make sure that we covered that adequately. Would you have any other thoughts about how medication becomes part of this larger picture of human rights of those who are suffering from these various disorders?
Well, one of the most fundamental ways that a person with mental illness gets treatment is through the appropriate administration of their medications. That is, to me, as an attorney, that is a dynamic that has to be achieved through the respect of the individual patient, allowing for his fundamental right of participation in treatment.
Okay.
The whole idea of informed consent has to come into play and be at all times adhered to. Okay, so how can there be informed consent without the provider giving appropriate information to the respective patient? You got to have that information, and there has to be listening on both sides. So to me, one of the requirements of any program, whether it's Western State, Region 10, the ARC, is that every person in treatment has to have something known as an Individualized Services Plan, an ISP. That's a requirement of the department under licensing and also the human rights regulations. What is that? To me, that's a contract. That's a contract between the provider, the doctor, and the client, consumer, patient, individual, whatever you want to call them. And in any contract, for it to be legal and binding, there has to be reciprocity.
Okay.
There has to be a mutual sharing, give and take, and there has to be the opportunity to say no. Okay? So my wife taught me this because she's the childbirth educator at Santerra Martha Jefferson Hospital. And she said, the anachronism that folks at Martha Jefferson use to talk about informed consent is brain. I hope I can remember it. B means benefits. R means risks. A means I'll come back to A.
Okay.
I means intuition, and N means do nothing.
Okay.
Oh, A, of course, A is big. A means alternatives.
Okay.
What are the alternatives to the proposed course of treatment? Okay. So if you know what the benefits and the risks are, if you know what the alternatives to this treatment would be, if you make an informed decision based on that information and follow your intuition, and also are told honestly what might would happen if we do nothing, now we've got a shot at understanding and having true informed consent.
Okay. You know, I'm reminded of, I mentioned this to you before we went on the air, that back in the early 70s, my first job at Western State Hospital as a unit psychologist. And in those days, recently had come on the market in those days that first line of antipsychotic drugs called phenothiazines, thorazine, stelazine, and the like. And they were being given in fairly high doses without consent. And these drugs have significant side effects, some of which are irreversible.
Tardive dyskinesia.
Exactly.
Being one.
Movement disorders that come as a side effect is often permanent. So it's such a contrast. I mean, it is such an improvement, really, over the days when no questions asked. People were just given these medications. They didn't know what they were. They didn't know what to expect, what the side effects were. Pretty skewed situation on the side of the treaters and the hospitals.
Right. Those were the bad old days.
Yes.
Thank God we don't exist in those anymore. It's quite a bit different.
Right.
And Jeff, if you were at Western State back in the day, in the 80s, 70s, 80s, have you been to the new Western State Hospital?
I have. And I can tell you, when I worked there, there were two sites, the so-called old site and the new site out on 250 going east. 3,000 patients.
Oh, my goodness.
3,000. And so many of those people were, again, warehoused. We're never going home. I mean, some of those wards were truly snake pits. I mean, the smell alone would, because the hygiene was so poor, would knock you over. I mean, we have come, in my lifetime, in my professional lifetime, light years we've come.
Yes. I got to Western State in 1988. There were about 800 patients there. And you can see the trend was going down. Today, at the new state-of-the-art Western State Hospital.
Beautiful facility.
The census is 249 patients.
Yes.
Quite a bit different.
Yeah. My one concern of that had always been, and this I think goes to human rights as well, is that the idea was when we begin to empty the hospitals, deinstitutionalize, the money should follow into the community. Well, it really didn't. I mean, so we end up with a lot of homeless people with serious mental illness. You know, it was just too tempting for the governing bodies around the country, I think, not to let the money follow people into outpatient treatment. And that's, to me, is a travesty.
I absolutely concur.
Yeah.
Money following the person has always been an ideal that's not been realized, at least not fully.
Yeah. President Kennedy, I think, started the movement to deinstitutionalization, but the dream really was never realized. When I look at the demands put on our colleagues, say, at Region 10 at an outpatient clinic, and the kind of caseloads and the situations they're dealing with. I mean, they are really trying to scrape together a viable program, and it's very unfortunate. Let's move on, if we can, and talk about the big elephant in the room, the HIPAA statute. And I'm going to ask you to define that, if you would, for our listeners, and then how that relates to human rights.
Well, HIPAA has been incorporated in the human rights regulations since... at least since the early 2000
right.
version of the regulations. Every few years, the regulations get reviewed and updated. But I can tell you, since the year 2003, with that iteration of the regulations, HIPAA has been incorporated. I believe HIPAA came on the books in 1995.
That sounds
something
right.
Something like that. And they've always been incorporated to a greater or lesser degree. But in the year 2003, with that iteration of the regulations, they were absolutely part of the regulations.
And just so our listeners know, HIPAA is the federal regulation that primarily addresses the issue of the privacy of protected health information, basically your patient record.
Right. HIPAA is in two parts, basically.
Okay.
The first is the confidentiality of a patient's medical or psychiatric record, and the goal there being to protect the confidentiality of an individual's private information. The second part of HIPAA is the access of an individual to their own record or their ability to amend their record in case there was an error in the record. So those are two basic human rights that are part of the regulations. A patient has the right to expect that their information shall be maintained by their providers at all times in a confidential manner. And second, they shall have access to their record upon request, and if they discover that there's a mistake in their record, the ability to correct the mistake. So that's the general fundamental HIPAA concept. To me, it's been an eroding sort of right.
Okay.
Throughout the years. And I say that because in the human rights regulations, I think there are 27 specific exceptions to my original statement that all information must be maintained in a confidential manner. There are various groups or individuals who can have access to one's individual record.
So it's been chipped away. I mean, some of the protection has been chipped away over the years.
Yeah. Well, third-party payers get access.
Right.
And then a variety, the court gets access.
Correct.
If a person's mental health is coming into question in a case. And other statutory exceptions, if you will, to the HIPAA doctrine of absolute confidentiality. It's not absolute.
Right. So when you were, perhaps still are, working with clients, does the HIPAA violations, they must come up on your radar, and they certainly must have come up on your radar at Western State.
They do.
Okay.
So whenever somebody alleges that they've their confidentiality has been breached, I know Western State did a very good job of taking, number one, taking that kind of an allegation seriously and then responding to it. Taking it seriously means, in a very quick period of time, conducting an investigation and then determining if a breach has occurred and then trying to remedy the breach as best that they can.
Okay.
If there's a mistake on a person's record, there are remedies for a person to correct the mistake. Think of how important it is to have your confidential record, which is in the hands of other people now, such as subsequent providers, corrected. Otherwise, a mistake will be perpetuated.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. It's a complicated issue, and I know clinicians struggle with managing patient information, confidential information, because of HIPAA and the concerns for really being charged with a HIPAA violation, that somehow something slipped between the cracks and the patient comes back and says, you know, how did my uncle end up with my diagnosis or something? And then we're off to the races. So
HIPAA training is a requirement of everybody within the system.
Yeah.
I dare say everybody at Region 10, everybody at Western State, and all the licensed programs are aware of the various aspects of HIPAA and are advised to follow very strictly.
Is it also applicable in your ART clients and in your adult home, group home clients?
Sure.
So it's everybody.
Sure, it's everybody.
It's you and me.
So even our clients who lack capacity, okay?
Meaning they don't have the capacity to make decisions on their own behalf.
We should talk a little bit about the importance of capacity and self-determination in this whole process.
Yeah, talk to us about that, if you would.
Yeah. To me, the threshold issue for any person coming into treatment, whether they're a new admission at Western State or a person knocking on the door for services in the community in some respect, the first issue that the provider should determine is the capacity of that individual to make their own informed consent decisions. Now, you and I are presumed to have capacity. Why? because we're over the age of 18. And the legal presumption is when you're 18, you make your own decisions. But that presumption is rebuttable. It can be overcome if a person has a significant mental disorder which would compromise their capacity to make their own decisions in their own best interest.
And
so we have to figure that out before we do anything else.
And is that a pretty high bar in terms of finding somebody that lacking in their capacity to make their own decisions, Chuck?
I don't think it's a high bar, no.
Okay.
I think a person can understand. If you speak to a person and you, as Denzel once said in the movie Philadelphia, tell it to me like I'm a six-year-old.
Right.
I love that line because it's so true. If you can explain yourself in a manner that a young person can understand, then I don't know if you ever had conversations like this with children, and they'll follow every answer you give with why.
Yes.
But why? And it forces you to break it down so that you can explain it. Why not with our clients? So we presume that our clients with intellectual disabilities, when they reach 18, have the capacity to make their own informed consent decisions.
And
now,
this is
what forces many parents, by the way, to consider guardianship.
Yes, because that's a tough one in a lot of situations. I've certainly worked with cases, as I'm sure you have, where someone turns 18, and then do we have to go to a legal process to find that to establish that they lack capacity? I mean, it can be a complicated process, can it not?
It can. You know, the year was 1998, and that was the year that the General Assembly changed the Code of Virginia with respect to guardianship. Pre-1998, guardianships were done, and often a person who was the subject of a guardianship had their self-determination rights essentially stripped away to the point where they did not make very many, if at all, any decisions.
And the guardian would make those decisions on their behalf.
The guardian would be appointed by the circuit court to make those decisions over one's person or guardianship over one's property, you know, if it was a dual case. 1998 was the year that I think the General Assembly finally, and it was through the urging of the Virginia State Bar that the statute be changed to incorporate this concept of self-determination on the part of the person who was the subject of a guardianship, so that the circuit court would be mindful of their responsibility to assure to the greatest degree possible the individual decision-making of that individual.
Okay.
So we don't strip away their personhood.
Right. Yeah. Boy, it gets complicated. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Mind and Heart Show. I am your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. We're very happy today to have with us in the studio our guest, Chuck Collins, an attorney who specializes in human rights, particularly for the mentally ill and the developmentally handicapped. We're going to just take a quick break, and we'll be right back with you, so please stay tuned. And we are back. This is the Mind and Heart Show on WPVC 94.7 FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're here every Saturday morning from 9 to 10. I'm your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. My producer today is Morgan Geyer. And we want to get back to the discussion with Chuck Collins about this issue of human rights for the mentally ill or the developmentally handicapped. Before the break, we were talking about capacity and the lack of capacity to make one's own decisions and make them in an appropriate way. So, Chuck, I wanted to just follow up with that and ask you as well about capacity as it relates to aging, dementia, Alzheimer's, since we baby boomers are starting to bump up against those questions. I'm guessing the same body of law applies there as well.
It does. It does. My advice, you didn't say give me your advice, but here's my advice, especially as it affects folks with getting older and perhaps experiencing some of those dementia problems. Get yourself an advance directive,
And tell us what that is.
Everybody needs one, in my opinion. An advance directive is a legal document that doesn't require the administration of a lawyer to execute it. Can be done by oneself or with some help at the hospital. But what it is a document that does two things. Number one, it allows a person who has capacity to make decisions or express a point of view with respect to end-of-life treatment that they might want. That's the first half of an advance directive.
Sort of like whether to pull the plug or not.
Exactly. Or how dramatic the intervention that you want to see happen.
Okay.
Under all costs, do whatever you can to save me.
As opposed to no extraordinary means.
Exactly. At least it gives that individual, while they still have capacity, the opportunity to make that declaration. And number two, and I think the more useful part of an advance directive, is the nominating a person to act as your agent under an advance directive. It's like a medical durable power of attorney.
Okay.
That's incorporated in an advance directive. And this is a document that says, I want this person to act as my agent if there comes a time when I lack the capacity to make my own decisions. So that's one proactive step that people can take to anticipate that they might lose capacity. I have one.
I have one. My wife has one, yes.
And all my friends, I say, do you have one?
Yes.
If you don't, I'll help you.
Yes.
Okay, but so that's one step, and it does affect people. Okay, is there a time when somebody gets older and requires a guardianship? Well yeah. But a guardianship, you got to remember, a guardianship is an adversarial proceeding. What's happening is that something's being taken away. Fundamental rights are being removed, and therefore it is an adversarial proceeding. And therefore, a heightened level of proof is required. It's what the law calls the middle tier.
Okay.
A clear and convincing standard of proof. And clear and convincing means that the court is clearly convinced that, number one, the person lacks capacity, and number two, a designated person is the right person to serve as the guardian.
Okay. I'm reminded of a number of cases in which I was involved over the years where one series of these come to mind, where an elderly person has developed dementia. A grown child, perhaps, is writing checks from their account. Another sibling finds out about it. It comes into court. The court has to determine then, does the elderly person lack capacity? Does a guardian need to be appointed to protect them from someone stealing from them in these instances? I mean, that's the kind of sort of complex issue, I'm guessing,
it is
bump into
complex.
All the time.
Yeah. Therefore, if a person is in that kind of in-between ground, and what should they do? If they still maintain what I'm going to call testamentary capacity, they should, and I'll explain that, they should execute a power of attorney.
Okay.
In other words, they can say who they want to make their decisions in the event that they eventually do lose capacity. So it can be a general power of attorney that handles essentially financial matters. It can be a medical durable power of attorney that handles, or it can be a combination of both.
Okay.
But you're anticipating that there might be a problem. Two different kinds of capacity. One is called testamentary capacity, and the other is called contractual capacity. The lower standard is testamentary capacity, and that's when a person has the requisite capacity to make a decision about executing a will.
Okay.
I, Jeff Frazier, being of sound mind, meaning you're not incapacitated,
right,
do hereby declare this to be my last will and testament. Well, I know that I have property. I know that I have these people who I want to leave it to. That's a very low...
Okay.
You don't have to know everything about your property, but you do have to have the desire to make a will and give and trust this in this property to these individuals, or at least name an executor to carry out your wishes. That's kind of a low standard. Contractual capacity is something that is much more sophisticated. I have the ability to know what's in my own best interest, make choices about this drug or that drug, or refuse, and I have the wherewithal, the strength to refuse.
Okay.
That's a higher level. And the so the court...
And more specific.
Yes, and much more specific. So the low level of capacity is useful in terms of that individual naming somebody else to make their decisions for them. The court is probably going to use the higher level to make a determination about guardianship and about whether this person needs a guardian. Okay. Now, as I said earlier, since 1998, guardianship orders are more tailored when they're being written to carve out areas where, preserve areas where an individual can make their own decisions, but be mindful and say what they can't do.
Okay. Excellent.
Yeah. Idea.
I'm conscious of the time, and I really wanted to have you share with us some information about what's going on currently in your professional life, both with regard to your being a consultant with Arc of the Piedmont and also the Transitions Council. Well, tell us a bit, if you would, about both of those endeavors.
Thank you. So I said earlier that Arc of the Piedmont is like my alma mater. So I started out with them before I went to the department. I was the executive director there for 3 years and met wonderful people like Lloyd and Barbara Barrett. Both, Lloyd was the president of the ARC when I was there, and Barbara is the president of it now. So things have really come full circle. And while I'm speaking about Barbara Barrett, she wrote a book, A Life of Never Evers, and it's a wonderful book about self-advocacy and her fighting the wars, if you will, and advocating for her unfortunately deceased daughter, Lena. Anyway, you got to have her on your program, Jeff.
Boy.
And let her go through her journey of self-advocacy with you.
I'll definitely take you up on that recommendation.
Good. But you asked me about what I'm doing now. I'm advocating for all of the clients in at the Arc of the Piedmont and advocating for the organization itself. I've recently taken on the responsibility for being the chair of something called the Transition Council. The Transition Council is a wonderful group that was originally started by a lady by the name of Billy Campbell, who works for the Thomas Jefferson Planning District, and did a wonderful job chairing that organization for about 11 years. Had to, because of other job obligations, had to finally relinquish responsibility for that committee, and so the ARC assumed it. The Transition Council is composed of parents, special educators, and providers in the community who are joined in their effort to make better outcomes for special education students who are transferring out of special education services.
Which happens at 21?
22.
22.
Well, the funding runs out at 22, but many folks leave earlier than that because they graduate.
Mm-hmm.
So they leave services between the ages of 18 and 22, let's say, and they come into the real world, as I call it. Well, the real world is not as endowed with the services as perhaps that young person was receiving while they were still in school. So it's a reality check. So what the Transition Council aims to do is to provide information and support for these families and special education students by rallying around all those individual providers and other interested folks in the Transition Council. Now, we're going to have an event, and this is what I really wanted to tell folks about. Under the leadership of a lady by the name of Deborah Anama, whom I have recently met and come to greatly respect, she leads the Parent Resource Center, and sponsors, and she's sponsored for the last 4 years, a seminar, a conference called Life After High School Transition Fair. That transition fair is going to occur at K-Tech
on Ryle Road
on Saturday, March the 19th, less than a month away, March the 19th, from 8:30 to 12:30. And anyone interested in attending should contact Deb Anama at PREP, which is part of Parent Resource Center, which is part of Albemarle County Schools.
Okay, through Albemarle County Schools.
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm hoping that we get a real good turnout. We have people from Legal Aid Justice Center,
mm-hmm,
and WorkSource Enterprise, Region 10, Compass, Arc of the Piedmont, Craig, which is the autism group.
Right.
Sponsored by a new friend of mine, my new best friend, Bob Krebs, who's doing a wonderful job there. So we've got such a group of committed people and talented people if we could just have a successful fair, that would warm my heart. I'm hoping that happens.
It's so encouraging to hear of that and hear of all the effort that's going in. You know, not so many years ago, these folks were shuffled off to an institution like Lynchburg Training School and just warehoused there in some pretty, at times, horrible conditions. This whole idea of services in the community and treating folks with dignity and respect and pushing them to rise to their own level of ability, you know, I think it's just wonderful.
Those are all ideas whose time has come.
Yes.
Absolutely. The Department of Behavioral Health is in the process of reducing the census at their training centers. And I remember when I started out Lynchburg, it was called Central Virginia Training Center in Amherst, Virginia, outside of Lynchburg, had over 1,500 patients. 1,500 residents, and there are maybe 300 there now. It's amazing.
Many years ago, when my father, who's now deceased, he was chairman of the state hospital board and took me there with him on a tour. I was already in practice, and boy, it was tough. I mean, not a happy place, and the ratio of staff to resident was, you know, appallingly low, or high, I guess, you know, 1 to 50, 1 to 100, whatever. So it's just terrific to see these programs getting into the community, having all these wonderful organizations come together to help and provide support. It's just all good.
Well, the most difficult problem that face, in my opinion, the most difficult problem that faces folks with mental illness or folks in the intellectual disability community is adequate housing. Okay. We've made great advances in terms of treatment for mental illness through the advent of new drugs, excellent committed staff, programs that deal with intensive case management, and excellent community options like Clubhouse.
Yes.
Blue Ridge Clubhouse, by the way, is one of my favorite places. I love that place, and I will
always... It's a
always,
day program for folks.
Yeah. And it is one of my all-time favorite places. The same for clients with intellectual disabilities. There are excellent programs in the community that provide day support services and group home experiences and supported residential programs.
Right.
However, we still don't have enough,
right,
to meet the needs of all of the folks that are trying to leave our training centers.
Right.
And until our commitment to the community equals that need, we'll still have the problem.
Yeah. And I think it's important to interject here that the State Department of Social Services licenses these group homes and adult homes and tries to keep an eye on them to make sure they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, providing adequate care, adequate supervision, adequate nutrition, medication, whatever. So we have that built into the system as well. It's not just you and I going out here and renting a house and putting a bunch of folks in it. There are regulations that attempt to protect the individuals who are residing there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
don't let anybody say that we don't need regulations or that the age of the regulatory society is over. We absolutely need regulations. We need licensing regulations, and we need human rights regulations that establish at least the base, the floor, below which nobody can go.
Yeah, that's so important.
How would the whole key that I have is, would I want my son or daughter in that program?
Right.
Would I?
Yeah.
If the answer is yes, we're going to be fine. And if the answer is no, we got a problem.
Yeah. And sadly, one of the things that I think comes up sometimes is the whole not in my backyard. You know, there'll be an attempt to open another home, and then the neighborhood will say, oh, no, we don't want these people living near us. And, you know, it's just the reality of people liking it in principle, but not necessarily wanting it in their backyard.
Exactly.
It's unfortunate, so... We are just about out of time. I wonder if you have any closing thoughts for us. Our guest today has been Chuck Collins, who's an attorney and previously the human rights advocate at Western State Hospital and other agencies, now consulting at the Arc of the Piedmont and continuing to do really good work in our community. So I just wanted to know if you had a wrap-up thought for us, Chuck, before we go off the air today.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Jeff. First of all, I want to thank you for inviting me. This has been a really good time, and for our support from Morgan over there.
She's a great producer.
She's doing great. And if I could just repeat the comment that I started out with. The best thing about me is my wife, Betsy, my son, Chris, my daughter, Gina, and my son, Patrick.
Well, you know, if you do nothing else in your life but have those folks in it, then you've probably done a good day's work. So,
thank you.
Great. So you've been listening this morning to the Mind and Heart Show. This is your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. We're here every Saturday morning from 9 to 10. Just a program note, our guest next week will be the Reverend Patricia Lansky, who's co-pastor at Unity Charlottesville. She's recently published a book on dealing with death, and it's not as morbid as it sounds. It's actually a very hopeful book. So tune in to my interview when I'll be talking to Reverend Patricia about her current book, rather. Stay tuned this morning for at the top of the hour for Straight Talk with Andra Hakes. She's an attorney who deals with criminal matters and LGBT matters, and I'm not sure who her guest is today, but she always has a terrific show, so stay tuned. And we'll talk to you next week. Check out the podcast starting Monday at cvillepodcast.com. Thanks again to Chuck for joining us today, and thanks again to Morgan for producing us. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to the Mind and Heart Show with your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. Be sure and tune in again next Saturday morning at 9 o'clock for another edition of the Mind and Heart Show, only on WPVC-LP, Charlottesville.